Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra plays concerts tonight and tomorrow night at the Marcus Center's Eline Hall. Although Ado DeVart is the music director and principal conductor for the symphony, the MSO each year brings in internationally regarded guest conductors as well.
This weekend, the award-winning Andrew Litton takes the helm for a program that includes works by Barber, Bernstein, and Prokofiev. For more than 30 years, Litton has led symphonies around the world, including Norway's Bergen Philharmonic, the Bournemouth Symphony in England, and here in this country, the Dallas and Denver Symphonies. Litton is with us in the studio now. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
I am so excited to finally meet you. I've been listening to your work for years and years and years, and just so excited that you're here in Milwaukee while I'm here in Milwaukee. Such a great program that you are working on.
It really is. It's an extraordinary collection of pieces, and I can't remember how it all came about, whether I suggested Bernstein or I suggested Prokofiev, but the one suggestion that actually came from the orchestra is the overture itself, which is really fun because I've never actually done it. So, you know, 33 years of professional conducting and somehow the Barber Overture has eluded me. So I'm very excited that there's actually a new piece for me on this program. But the other two pieces are very old friends indeed, and wonderful chance to get to do these great masterpieces, actually quite contemporaneous. They're both from the 1940s, the Prokofiev and the Bernstein.
I didn't realize the Bernstein was that young.
Yeah.
He was that young when he wrote it.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's quite extraordinary to have, you know, sort of two views of music at that time, you know.
Had they been listening to each other, do you know?
I think Bernstein was quite a fan of Prokofiev's, if I'm quite honest. There seems to be quite a bit of cross-pollination. Actually, the Bernstein is quite a bit more original in a way than the Prokofiev. The Prokofiev's is very much of a throwback, very romantic piece, really in the style of his Romeo and Juliet, you know. And I think in a way he had been kind of an enfant terrible, writing very dissonant, very out there music when he was in his 20s and 30s. And when he came back to the Soviet Union, he's one of these composers that sort of re-emigrated back, you know, to the fatherland. He just wrote in a more tonal style, I think, in the hopes that he'd be accepted more. And what's happened in a way is he's given us some of the most beautiful music ever written. You know, in a way, maybe some could say, well, it was a bit of a cop out after he was so dissonant and astringent in his youth. But in some ways, I mean, listen, there's many composers that have done that: Aaron Copland, Richard Strauss. You know, so maybe people push the envelope as far as they can, and then they decide, you know what, I want to write something you can sing.
I want to write something that is melodic and that I like to listen to.
Yeah.
And I think of those Prokofiev melodies, and it's just that, as you say, that sweeping, gorgeous. But again, it kind of harkens back to some of that dissonance in his youth. He kind of works it in, but it has that overlay of that gorgeousness.
Well, it's worked in with the skill that you're not sitting there going, oh, that's ugly. You're sitting there going, wow, that's really neat. That's spicy, you know. It's got really just the right amount of spiciness to make it exciting. And of course, both pieces have fantastic rhythmic sections. I mean, the Prokofiev, the second movement, is a wild romp, really. It's almost like you can imagine a sleigh ride through the snow. I know, don't mention snow. But it's really got that wonderful character. And then the last movement, once it gets going, it's kind of almost like watching some sort of factory madly at work churning out something, you know. But this is this mechanical nature of it that's quite overwhelming in a way and very exciting. I mean, it's really like grinding of gears and
widgets being made,
yeah. And it's just brilliant stuff. And then you've got this gorgeously romantic third movement that's, as I mentioned, Romeo and Juliet, could be right out of there, sort of an extended version. And the first movement is just – it's brilliant development of traditional symphonic form, but with these wonderful flights of fancy that only Prokofiev could give us after a lifetime of writing ballets and operas, really. It's very much a dramatic symphony in that sense. It's got all the visual elements without having them. You know, you can see so many pictures when you listen to this music.
It is very theatrical, isn't it?
Yeah.
talk a little bit about the Bernstein, because I think probably a lot of people aren't as familiar with his symphonic works as they are, say, with the Broadway works or his later works. You know, this is a piece I don't know very well.
Well, it's I think, in many ways, his greatest work. He's jumping off the fence dramatically. Certainly of the serious genre, and I was making quotes with my hands as I said serious, because one can't deny the genius of West Side Story and Candide and works like that. But this is a purely symphonic work, and it was based on a poem by W.H. Auden called The Age of Anxiety, and it's basically four disparate people who come together in a desperate quest to find themselves. I mean, to make an dramatic oversimplification of a rather complicated plot. But in the process of trying to find themselves, Bernstein very cleverly uses the theme and variation concept in the first movement, except it's not the traditional theme and variations where you've got a melody and then it's varied through a variety of means. He actually takes a fragment from the preceding variation and varies that. So he's not actually varying a theme. He's varying some component of the variation that preceded it. And so they're all very tightly linked, but linked to each other, you know, individually. So it's quite fascinating. So he does two sets of seven variations, all featuring this solo piano as this, I guess, it's really almost a concerto for the piano, but at the same time, the orchestral part is so virtuosic, that's why it's called a symphony. You know, it's a hybrid piece for sure. Certainly need a world-class piano soloist to play the piano part. It's very demanding. And we're very lucky to have William Wolfram in town, who I cracked the orchestra up at rehearsal today because I've actually known Bill since I'm 11 years old. So I started saying stuff that I realized to an outsider might have been semi-disrespectful. And then I thought, you know, I better explain myself because they're probably like, God, that Litton guy's really rude.
And he doesn't like the pianist. How is this going to work?
How could he say that about the pianist to his face? And no, we have lots of laughs. And in fact, we were both studying privately with the same teacher who was chairman of the piano faculty, Juilliard, on Saturdays. And I started when I was 11, and I think he was 14. And he'd always have the lesson before me. And I've teased him to this day. In fact, the orchestra was roaring with laughter when I told the story. And Bill puts his head down on the piano like, don't tell this story again. And it really was almost every week without fail that the teacher would say, Andrew, why can't you play this like Bill? And my tagline on that is that I haven't needed years of therapy is testament to my strength of character.
You are an accomplished pianist, of course. And so when you're in the conductor's role for a piece like this that requires such a virtuosic keyboardist, how do you separate yourself? I mean, I know you have to. You know, you're a conductor first, but you must be thinking about it as a pianist as well.
Well, very much so. And I mean, thank you for qualifying that, because I'm very much a conductor who plays piano rather than a pianist who conducts. I started piano when I was just before I turned six. But when I was 10, I fell in love with the idea of being a conductor. And from that moment on, and by the way, I was attending a Leonard Bernstein Young People's Concert in New York, so there's a link to this program. And I came out of that particular concert. I'd love to say it was the first one I went to. It'd make a much better story. It wasn't. It was the fourth or fifth one I went to, and he did Pines of Rome by Respighi, which is an incredibly colorful, evocative, and visceral piece. And I was just blown away by it. First of all, the way Lenny described each of the four vistas in Rome, and then how much the music sounded like what he described. It was incredible to me. And the colors and volume, sheer volume that an orchestra could make, I knew from that moment that piano was never going to do it for me. And I wanted to be able to control all that sonority. And so I came out of then Philharmonic Hall, now Avery Fisher Hall, and I said to my mother, who would always meet me and my little friend, his two little 10-year-olds, and I said, Mom, I want to be a conductor. And she just sort of rolled her eyes and said, yeah, whatever. Because until that morning, I wanted to be a fireman. So, you know, she just assumed it was as random.
As
whatever. So I was very serious, though. So piano was a great means to an end because it really helps to play the piano to be a conductor. It certainly helps with your accompanying because you do so much of it as a pianist. So there's that element to it. But I, you know, I don't get to practice that much. So I still play a bit. You know, I still perform the odd concerto and lots of chamber music. But I have so much respect for people who really do it for a living and play the piano. So all joking and all teasing aside, I have a huge amount of time and respect for Bill Wolfram. In fact, we work together enough, it's proof. You know, I was just telling somebody before that we, you know, actually played this very Age of Anxiety back in October with my orchestra in Norway, and we're about to play it with my orchestra in Denver, the Colorado Symphony, at the end of this month. But we also do other pieces together. We did Ives 4 in September in London at the Barbican. We're going to reprise that at the Proms next summer, and then we're going to Tokyo. As a matter of fact, our wives must be wondering why we're spending so much time together. But anyway, we're going to Tokyo in June to do the Schoenberg Piano Concerto. So we really, you know, we are kind of the odd couple in a way. We seem to
work together. These pieces.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about doing all of these different things with all of your different orchestras. And that seems to be the state of conducting today, that you have many orchestras. I mean, there was a time, like Leonard Bernstein was a good example of that. It was Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic.
Right.
I mean, he might have guest conducted elsewhere, but it was them. You know,
yeah.
The two of them were inseparable, and you had many other conductors who were like that. But that has seemed to not be the way it is for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it is – it depends on how long the orchestra's season is. But very often, orchestras only want a music director to be around for 10 weeks, 12 weeks. So what do you do with the other, you know, 40 of the year? And often in my case, particularly at the moment, I have actually three titles of music director titles going, but one is ending, and that's the Bergen title. I'm finished there on October 8th. It will be 12 and a bit years, actually, that I've been music director there. It's been a fantastic tenure. In fact, I'm staying on as music director laureate, which will still be 3 weeks a year. But the Denver position just started 2 years ago. So there's always a bit of an overlap. And then in September, I'm starting with the New York City Ballet. I finally get to work and work from home in New York. I can't wait. I'm very excited about that job. But see, by then, Bergen will be finishing up. So I will just actually only have two jobs. And finally, also, the two jobs will be in the same country. Mind you, pretty far apart in the same country. But
still, a little bit of an easier flight than
– No passports required. Yes.
Right. And no oceans to cross necessarily.
Right.
But you'll keep doing the kind of guest things that you're doing here?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's really important. And in fact, I just came off a plane from Germany. We had a concert on Sunday, actually. Wonderful opera arias with some young, talented, up-and-coming singers. And the week before, I was in Bournemouth, which was my original orchestra, my very first job as a music director.
I think that's the first time I ever heard you.
Yeah.
Yeah, on recording.
That's another example of a great relationship. I've been conducting them every year since I left in 1994. So it's a long tradition of an annual appearance. And it's quite amazing now. There's only about five players left from my day. But, of course, since I've been there every year, I've watched the change. It's not the shock it would have been if 20 years had gone by and I walked in again and was like, where is everybody? But it's really wonderful because there's still a chemistry somehow, even though there's no explanation for it. It's not the same people. But there's still a wonderful chemistry there, and it's great to have those ongoing relationships, even if it is just once a year.
You talk about the chemistry, and I think that's so important between – well, certainly between musicians who are playing in an orchestra, but also the conductor. You have to fit. You guys have to understand each other.
Yeah, and it's very elusive, and of course, it's the old story. If somebody could figure out the key, they'd be extremely rich or make a lot of conductors very happy. But there is no key, and there's no explanation as to why it sometimes works and why it sometimes doesn't. I just go in with the attitude that, look – I love music. I know you love music. It's hard to actually play it well. So let's just work together to make this the best possible concert. And if that works with everybody, and it seems to, touch wood, be working here in Milwaukee, you know, if that works with everybody, then we're winning. And so is the music. And if it doesn't, well, you know, this week will end too.
And there'll be someplace else to go, and hopefully they won't lose your luggage.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that would be nice, yes.
So, well, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. I am so looking forward to the concert. Will you be back? Are you hoping to come back?
Definitely. But this is one of those things. It's not up to me. It's up to the powers that be at the Milwaukee Symphony. But I absolutely loved being back, and they're sounding amazing. They're playing really well.
Well, Andrew Litton, such a pleasure.
Thank you. For me too.
Andrew Litton will be the guest conductor for concerts by the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra tonight and tomorrow at the Marcus Center. You will find more information from links at WUWM.com. And that is all the time we have for today's show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Besides the two of us, there is a team of people that bring you this show, including Dan Harmon's technical mastery, the web support of Michelle Maternowski, studio engineering from John Strelecki, and production assistance from Audrey Nowakowski and Claire Mosley.
Thanks so much for listening today. Don't forget to join us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's all on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.